Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, April 22nd, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Taking a look at the front page of the Globe Gazette, neither the Monday paper today nor the Sunday paper has much, neither of them have much local content at all. So I'm going back to the Saturday Globe Gazette, and we'll catch you up on what's been going on in the paper. First story, Amazon facility coming to Mason City. New Amazon last mile facility announced on south side of Mason City. Amazon has announced plans to break ground on a last mile distribution facility in Mason City. The new 50,000-square-foot facility will be located near the Avenue of the Saints / U.S. Highway 18, providing great access throughout the region. As reported in the Globe Gazette earlier this month, a site plan for a distribution center warehouse proposed by Seafried Industrial Properties at 43rd Street Southwest and South Washington Avenues was approved by the Mason City Planning and Zoning Board of Adjustment on March 5. The site is adjacent to the Iowa State Patrol District Office. The North Iowa Corridor EDC and City of Mason City worked with the company's development team to identify and secure the project site and complete necessary site approvals, according to a press release. The new facility will enable fast, everyday delivery directly to Amazon customers' doorsteps. Packages are transported to delivery stations from Amazon fulfillment and sorting centers, and local employees will process customer packages for last-mile delivery to their doorstep. Quote, "We're grateful for our partnership with Mason City and Cerro Gordo County, as this last-mile facility will allow us to better serve our customers in North Iowa." That was from Jason Van Gallis, manager of economic development for Amazon. The quote continues, "We look forward to continue working with North Iowa Corridor EDC to launch Amazon's first facility in the area and sharing more details in the future." Since 2010, Amazon has created more than 4,500 full and part-time jobs in Iowa and invested more than $1.5 billion across the state, including infrastructure and compensation to employees, according to a company press release. Those investments have contributed an additional $1.3 billion to the Iowa economy and helped create more than 6,200 indirect jobs, from jobs in construction and logistics to professional services. In addition, more than 2,500 independent sellers, mostly small and medium-sized businesses in Iowa, sell to customers in Amazon's store, creating thousands of additional jobs. Quote, "The establishment of Amazon's distribution center in Mason City presents a unique opportunity for job creation, economic growth, and increased access to goods and services for our residents," said Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel. He continues, "We must also carefully consider the potential impact on local businesses and infrastructure as we navigate this exciting new chapter in our city's development." It's been great working with Seafried Industrial Properties and the Amazon development team to locate this project in Mason City, said Chad Schreck, president and CEO of the North Iowa Corridor. Quote, "Amazon's investment exemplifies Mason City's important role as a regional hub for industry and logistics across North Iowa, and we're excited to continue to build on that momentum," unquote. Our next story comes from the front page of the Globe Gazette from Saturday. Once again, the Sunday and Monday editions didn't have pretty much any local news. I'll read it all, but we're going to start back here on Saturday. This one is Hiking the Appalachian Trail with Mitch Myers, a series. And it shows hiker Mitch Meyer of Mason City preparing lightweight hiking and camping items ahead of his trek along the Appalachian Trail. Mitch Meyer is taking a walk. Most North Iowans like to explore their neighborhoods or a local wildlife area. Mason City resident Meyer intends to walk the full length of the Appalachian Trail starting Tuesday, April 23rd. The Globe Gazette will follow along on his adventure with upcoming photos, video, and stories from the trail. He's leaving Mason City on Monday, today. He'll begin his adventure on the approach trail in Amakalola Falls, Georgia, the following day. The 14-mile approach trail is a single-day hike that will bring him to the main event. The Appalachian Trail is 2,190 miles long, stretching from Springer Mountain in Georgia through 14 states and ending at Mount Katahdin in Maine. That's Katahdin in Maine. Springer Mountain is officially step one, Meyer said. I'm a little behind the initial cohort for this season. Most people have left by the 1st of April. Meyer is what is known as a through hiker, hiking through the season to complete the trail's entire length. Through hikers generally prefer to complete the trail in around 150 days. In 2016, he completed it in 183 days. It was his first long-haul hike. While he researched and prepared, some things can only be learned by doing. It was a little looser plan than I carry out these days, he said. The first hike teaches a lot of lessons. Three well-known trails, the Appalachian Trail, the Continental Divide Trail, running through five western states, and the Pacific Crest Trail on the U.S. West Coast, together form what is known in the hiking world as the Triple Crown of Hiking. Meyer is a Triple Crown hiker. He knocked out the Appalachian Trail in 2016, the Pacific Crest in 2018, and the Continental Divide in 2020. Each is an extraordinary achievement on its own. Following his 2018 Pacific Crest trek, Meyer wondered whether his future would include other trails. Shortly after completing that trip, he was diagnosed with an aortic stenosis with a severe aortic aneurysm that required a surgery known as a Bentall procedure. The Bentall procedure replaces the aorta and its valve with an artificial device. During the surgery, his coronary artery was nicked, leading to an emergency bypass. A vessel was transplanted from his thigh to repair the coronary artery that was damaged. It was an unexpected graft, so it isn't a very neat and tidy scar, he said. He now takes blood thinners to prevent clotting. Meyer is setting out on his own, but he knows it won't be long before he finds compatriots of some sort. On the trails, he's known as Google for his expansive intellect and recall. Nicknames are common on the trails, as hikers pass in and out of the company of others for companionship and safety. Safety is something Myers takes seriously. The Appalachian Trail is managed by the National Park Service, the U.S. Forestry Service, and the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. Park rangers monitor frequently traveled areas, and volunteers walk short stretches to pack out garbage and watch for distressed hikers. What those organizations cannot police, however, is the wildlife. Meyer has had a couple of moments that have shaken him. I've seen a grizzly bear and a couple of bull moose, he said. When all the animals and birds around you quiet down, that's when you start to prick up your senses a little bit. Once I came around a bend and startled a mountain lion who was stalking a deer. They scattered and I took some very deep breaths. Weather events are another unpredictable concern. Above the tree line, lightning strikes are a real danger, he said. We're expecting a heavy hurricane season this year, so it's very much on my mind. There are more than 250 man-made shelters along the Appalachian Trail, an average of one every 9 miles. With thunderstorms springing up quickly in the mountainous regions, reaching shelter from the weather can be a mad dash. Sometimes you just have to hunker down and take the hits, Meyer said. There are a host of issues that hikers can encounter. Some are predictable, like stink. Day three is peak stink day, he said. Day five is all about the pain. It generally takes about 10 days to acclimate to hiking again. One thing no hiker acclimates to is the bugs. I use a permethrin treatment on all of my clothing before I head out. Between horseflies, deer flies, mosquitoes, and ticks, there's a lot of risk. Preparation for a hike of more than 150 days can take some time. Meyer has been through the steps enough times now that it's more of a chore than a stressful event. The lighter the pack, the happier you're going to be, he said with a wry laugh. Meyer's pack contains only what he'll need on the trail. His parents, Ruth and Rick Meyer, are his at-home supporters. Meyer carries a satellite beacon that lets them know in real time where he is. Internet service on the trail is spotty, and Meyer updates his family and followers as connectivity allows. Trail towns, off the trail but along the way, offer respite and internet service for thru-hikers. A McDonald's restock is an absolute delight. I'll upload my videos, order up a bunch of cheeseburgers, and then pack them out with me, he said. When it comes to food, high-calorie choices are tops. For the first leg of his hike, Meyer will be packing king-size candy bars for breakfast and chip packets and jelly beans for snacks. The trail towns allow Meyer to restock and receive goods from home. As he approaches a likely stop-off, Meyer lets his parents know what he needs. I'll pack a box with a fresh pair of shoes, his meds if he needs them, and as many high-calorie treats as possible, said his mother, Ruth. Meyer's experience has been that trail shoes last about 500 miles. Some of my equipment is getting a little worn, but I try to purchase items with a lifetime warranty, he said. I've sent back a few pairs of trail socks. On the trail, days are a mix of boring predictability and unexpected thrills. Meyer and other thru-hikers follow the tenet of leave no trace, leaving trails as close as possible to their natural state. That means packing out all refuse, staying on the trail, and avoiding all types of bushcraft. If you're unwell or in danger, there would be exceptions, of course, he said. A park ranger would rather have you build a small fire and stay alive than succumb to the weather or illness. When hikers do find themselves in a jam, they often turn to local residents, known as trail angels. These volunteers check on hikers and may even offer services like a ride out of town or to a medical facility. Miss Janet is my trail angel, Meyer said. She's got a van and the biggest heart of anyone I've met on the trails. Volunteers are often familiar with the region as well as the trail and can make quick work of an emergency situation. His first trip on the Appalachian Trail was a learning experience. He found joy in the changing days and knew there had to be a way to share it with the people he loves. On his Pacific Crest Trail hike, he started posting video updates. His YouTube channel, Saunter Beyond, viewers there can revisit his previous hikes and follow along as he tackles the Appalachian Trail in 2024. Meyer also has an Instagram account filled with video and stills from his prior hikes. I use the video as kind of a diary. Sometimes it's so beautiful or startling or unusual that it's great to be able to just share that directly with the people following along back home. And then this series is going to continue in the Globe Gazette. It says readers can follow Meyer as he tackles the challenges of navigating the Appalachian Trail on his fourth through hike in the United States. The Globe Gazette will feature regular updates from his travels, including photos and videos from the trail, dispatches from Meyer, and information about the geographic regions he travels through. Next story from the front page of the Saturday Globe Gazette. Mason City hedges risk of lawsuit as hotel deadline looms. The Mason City Council voted Tuesday to amend its agreement with the developers of a proposed downtown hotel to protect the city from lawsuits should the deal fall through. The unanimous vote concerns what will happen if developers David Raichy and Robert Johnson and their companies, which are MCCCH LLC and SBMC LLC, fail to meet a May 11th deadline to comply with terms of a deal to build a Hyatt Place hotel on the lot of Southbridge Mall and the renovation of the mall itself. The amendment protects the city from any lawsuits at the end of a 120-day period given to developers in January to come into compliance with the original development agreement. That deadline is May 11th. Johnson signed a document agreeing to the amendment on April 11th. Johnson is described in the documents as a manager for both companies. Raichy did not sign. According to the documents in the council packet published on masoncity.net, the developers received a default cure demand from Clear Lake Bank and Trust regarding a $3.75 million borrowed April 6th of 2022. A default cure demand typically allows a defaulting party an opportunity to remedy a default within a certain period before negative consequences apply. CLB&T then entered into a forbearance agreement with Southbridge Mason City LLC on July 31st. CBMC defaulted on that agreement. December 7th, another 10-day default cure was sent in which CLB&T demanded payment in full of more than $4 million that was the balance. December 5th, SBMC defaulted on that agreement. December 22nd, the City of Mason City paid $42,656. CLB&T, they paid that to CLB&T for interest due on the loan agreement. The city then prepared the amendment approved Tuesday night. CBMC LLC owes to CLB&T $3.75 million in principal, $18,750 in accrued interest, $3,586 in late charges, $78,910 in back property taxes, and $291,528 in tax sale redemptions, for a total amount of $4.14 million. Mayor Pro Tem Paul Adams asked the city administrator, Aaron Burnett, if the amendment will protect the city from lawsuits. In November 2018, Philip Chodur, that's C-H-O-D-U-R, sued the city after his company, called G8, received a notice of default on the original iteration of the River City Renaissance Hotel project. Burnett said the amendment is designed, in part, to protect the city from similar litigation. He told the council that defending a lawsuit is not only costly in regard to staff time and payments to law firms, but could also scare away potential developers who may take on the project. Quote, "This action will allow us to have a clean break with the developer should they not meet that 120-day deadline that they agreed to back in January, and that the city can move on and work this project with a different developer to execute the vision of the River City Renaissance," he said. His quote continues, "The preferred outcome would be to execute the agreement as was outlined originally and was outlined within the amendment that was made last year," he said. The April 6, 2022 agreement between SBMC, the city, and Stewart Title Company states that SBMC has included, quote, "a quitclaim deed conveying the entirety of the development property to the city upon the occurrence of certain events of default," unquote. Should the deadline pass, Mason City will own the mall and the area of parking lot where the hotel is proposed to be constructed. Councilman Joshua Mason asked, "Are the mall and hotel inextricably linked now?" Burnett's short answer was no. He said the council would have the option to execute future agreements as it sees fit. Since the city is constrained by its contract with Rachey and Johnson, staff have not had conversations with any new prospective developers. But Burnett said that there is interest in the project, and he believes should the deadline pass, other developers likely will step forward. One caveat is that a November amendment with SBMC LLC and MCCCH LLC transferred the planned ballroom from the hotel development into the mall development in order to secure financing. Burnett told Mason, "I do believe it will be in the best interest of the city to have the ballroom in the mall, as that solved a very big issue with the financing getting tied up with the convention center." SBMC and MCCCH have until May 11th to prove financial commitment. Our next story from Saturday's Globe Gazette, Iowa Ethics and Disclosure Board to investigate Wedmore complaint. The Iowa Ethics and Disclosure Board has agreed to investigate a complaint that Democratic Cerro Gordo County Auditor Adam Wedmore used a county postage meter when mailing campaign materials January 27th. Zach Goodrich, executive director and legal counsel for the Ethics Board, said during a meeting Thursday that in February, Wedmore self-reported to the Ethics Board that he had used a postage meter managed by Cerro Gordo County on 1,000 pieces of campaign mail. Wedmore later paid the county $650 for using the meter. The cost of the postage was $640, and Wedmore included an additional $10 to cover the cost of electricity and wear and tear. The Iowa Attorney General's Office declined to file criminal charges in the case. The state auditor also is investigating. Goodrich said the initial complaint to the Ethics Board came directly from Wedmore in February. Cerro Gordo County Board of Supervisors Chair Lori Meekum-Ganap, also a Democrat, reported the incident on February 26th on behalf of the Board of Supervisors. Meekum-Ganap also was investigated by the Ethics Board for a November 2022 complaint involving the misuse of county resources. She was reprimanded and fined $200 for the lapse. Section of South Pierce Avenue closed by derailment. A section of South Pierce Avenue will be closed into next week after a Wednesday night trail derailment in Mason City. At about 10:15 p.m. Wednesday, approximately 7 Union Pacific rail cars went off the tracks just south of the Pierce Avenue and 19th Street intersection at the Union Pacific rail yard. Union Pacific said no one was hurt and hazmat crews were not needed. The cars were carrying soybean meal and potash. Cleanup crews were on site quickly, and the incident is under investigation. In a post on X, formerly Twitter, Friday morning, the Mason City Police Department said it expects part of South Pierce Avenue will be closed into next week. The police department said to plan a route around the closure while the aftermath of the derailment is getting cleaned up. And now we'll turn to our obituaries from Saturday's paper in the Globe Gazette. Our first is Norma Kuykendall, age 88, of Charles City, passed away Tuesday, April 2nd at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City, surrounded by her loving family. Celebration of life will be Saturday, April 27, 4 to 7 p.m. at the VFW, which is located at 1505 North Grand Avenue in Charles City. Inurnment will be held Saturday, May 4th, 10 a.m. at the Sunnyside Memory Gardens in rural Charles City. Next is Juanita Henning. Juanita Irene Henning, loving matriarch, born January 24, 1931 in Marble Rock, Iowa, passed away April 5th, 2024. Services in Naples, Florida, May 13th, 11 a.m. at the United Church of Christ in Naples with a luncheon to follow. She will be laid to rest on Marco Island. Memorials can be sent to the Bargain Basket Thrift Shop on Bald Eagle Drive in Marco Island, Florida, or the Emmanuel United Church of Christ in Latimer, Iowa. Next is Helen Faber, 93, of Manly, passed away April 17th. Massive Christian burial is taking place this morning at the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Manly. Donald Harold Weber, age 97, passed away March 13th at Mercy One in Mason City. Visitation, April 25, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Trinity Lutheran Church on North Pennsylvania Avenue. Memorial services, Friday, April 26th, 10 a.m. at the same church. Military honors will be conducted by the Mason City Veterans Memorial Association, and memorials may be directed to Trinity Lutheran Church, KCMR, or the donor's choice. Per Don's wishes, his body was donated to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester for medical research, especially research on diabetes and Parkinson's disease. Stephen M. Molstad, age 73 of Manly, passed away Saturday, April 13th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. Cremation has taken place according to his wishes, and a celebration of life will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the VFW in Clear Lake. And now taking a look at the one local story in Sunday's paper, legislature adjourns in early morning hours. After two marathon sessions totaling 38 hours across a little over 2 days, Iowa lawmakers concluded their work for 2024 in the early morning hours Saturday at the Capitol. The House was the second chamber to finish its work, adjourning at 4:23 a.m. Saturday, the 104th legislative day of the session. The 2024 session was marked by one piece of legislation in particular, Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to overhaul how special education support is delivered in the state by its 9 area education agencies and how those agencies are funded. The AEA bill dominated the first 3 months of the legislative session, making progress on anything else nearly impossible. After hours of public testimony from parents of students with disabilities who worried that their children would lose critical care, along with testimony from some school superintendents who backed the proposal, Reynolds signed the final bill into law in March. Once the bill is fully phased in, the area education agencies will receive 90% of school funding for special education support, while 10% will remain with the district. State lawmakers worked late into the night Thursday and Friday and into the early morning hours Saturday as they crafted an $8.5 billion state budget, passed the last batch of policy bills, and let a final few bills die, including a proposed 5-year extension of a moratorium on new casinos in the state. The House approved the new casino moratorium just before 1 a.m. Saturday, but in the session's final 3 hours, the Senate declined to take up the bill. That means the current 2-year moratorium will expire when it ends in June. After that point, interested parties will be able to start the application process through the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Grimes, claimed victories for State House Republicans on another round of state income tax cuts, immigration, and inflation. Big and bold ideas have always been our focus, and our caucus has never shied away from difficult or complex issues, and this year was no different, Whitfer said in a statement. His statement continues, "This session was another tremendous success for Senate Republicans as we kept our promises to Iowans and focused on both big reforms, bold changes, and major tax relief. I know we all look forward to a break from this session and to return in 2025, ready to continue making Iowa the best place to live in the world," unquote. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican of New Hartford, said House Republicans laid out an agenda at the start of the session and followed through on passing those bills. Quote, "We've been doing that since I've been in leadership, trying to really lay out a bold agenda that we campaign on, try to follow through on them," Grassley said. "The things that we're taking from all across the state in all 99 counties, we're trying to reflect those in the legislation that we're putting together," unquote. House Democratic Leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights said the session had been defined by Republicans making life harder for Iowans in areas like voting, economic opportunity, and special education. Confirst criticized State House Republicans for moving the AEA overhaul bill despite initial unease from many in the party about Reynolds' first proposal. She said the bill mobilized thousands of people who were opposed to the changes. "It was never about the AEAs. It's always been about politics. It's always been about special interests," she said, "and kids are going to suffer." Confirst said House Democrats, meanwhile, had been proposing policies that had broad support among Iowans and would improve living conditions in the state. House Democrats introduced bills this year to increase the state's minimum wage, create a constitutionally protected right to collective bargaining, and extend the state's sales tax holiday. With a minority in both chambers, Democrats have little ability to influence policy. We introduced all of those things, and Republicans ignored each and every one of them, Comfort said. The things we've introduced as legislative sessions were for everyday Iowans to help make their lives better, and Republicans chose politics and special interests. Senate Democrats pursued many of those same policies. They introduced a constitutional amendment that would have protected abortion rights in the Iowa Constitution and introduced policies to increase funding and staffing at nursing homes. Senate Minority Leader Pam Yoakum, Democrat of Dubuque, said on Friday that Democrats had worked to improve, quote, freedom, opportunity, and accountability throughout the session. Yoakum, who is not running for re-election, suggested the Republicans' policy agenda will be a liability in the November election. Quote, Iowans will remember how Republicans chose to serve their governor rather than their constituents, Yoakum said. They'll remember how they slashed our area education agencies and put special interests over Iowa's children, and they will remember in November, unquote. Governor Kim Reynolds' office highlighted the myriad bills that she proposed or supported that were approved by the Republican majority legislature, some of which were altered significantly before coming back to her desk, including the AEA bill. Quote, Iowa has set a course for transformation, and it was the driving force of the 2024 legislative session, Reynolds said in a statement. Her statement continues, Iowa is a state that values education, rewards hard work, and encourages strong families, a place where government is driven by a sense of responsibility to the people it serves. I'm proud of what we accomplished this year. I look forward to continuing to build upon our strong foundation, ensuring prosperity and stability for every Iowan, unquote. And that's all the time we have to catch you up on the articles in the Mason City Globe Gazette. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for folks with print disabilities. And now we'll take a look at the Fort Dodge Messenger. And the stories on the front page of this morning's Messenger. A big photo of a family all wearing the same t-shirt. Says, generations of families together as one. Our next article is Fort Dodge Council to act on $117 million budget. EPA allowing summer sales of higher ethanol gasoline blend. And corn crib destroyed in Sunday blaze. So we'll start at the top with generations of families together as one. 41st Friends of St. Edmund Ball is set for May 4th. The 41st annual Friends of St. Edmund Ball is set to take place on May 4th. Best Western Starlight Village Inn and Suites on 3rd Avenue Northwest will once again serve as the host site, with co-chairs this year Chris and Gina Carzoli and Brett and Teresa Webster, beginning at 6 p.m. The theme is Generations of Families Together as One, to celebrate the family culture of the school. We're a third-generation St. Edmund family and are looking forward to meeting those who are just joining our community, said Teresa Webster. Whether you're a multiple-generation family or a one and only, we're all united with the same goals that our school provides. Eighth grader Irene Sogue created the logo that will be used in print, and Emma Barwin created the one that will be used at the ball as a decoration. Buffet dinner will be served until 7:30. The Spirit of St. Edmund Awards will be presented during the dinner. Both live and silent auctions are set. Online bidding started April 20th, and you can join in that at www.biddingforgood.com/SEBall, and that bidding continues through May 4th. We're excited to bring out the teacher wish list board, said Gina Carzoli. I love to be a part of anything that gives back and helps support our teachers and staff. There will also be a wine and whiskey pull as Salty View provides live entertainment. We've really enjoyed our time at the ball the last few years and wanted to get more involved and give back, said Chris Carzoli. Next story from the front page of today's Messenger. Fort Dodge Council to act on $117 million budget includes property tax rate hike. Months of number crunching will conclude this evening when the Fort Dodge City Council acts on the proposed budget for fiscal year 2024-2025. The budget calls for spending around $117.6 million. It includes a property tax rate of $20.95 per $1,000 of taxable value. The council's work will begin 5:30 p.m. in the municipal building on First Avenue South with a workshop on the budget. The council's regular business meeting will begin at 6 p.m. The budget is for the fiscal year that will begin July 1 and conclude June 30, 2025. Total spending set at $117,623,294. That's down from the current year's spending of about $161 million. However, the property tax rate will be up about 20 cents from the current rate of $20.74 per $1,000 of taxable value. The city's property tax rate hit 20.95 per $1,000 of taxable value previously in 2016. The budget also includes revenue from water and sanitary sewer rate increases that went into effect on January 1. At that time, water rates went up 8% and sanitary sewer rates went up 6%. The proposed budget is far from the only thing on tonight's agenda. The council will consider a development agreement with Nestle Purina Pet Care for an expansion of its plant at 2400 Fifth Avenue South. Under the agreement, the company will invest a minimum of $175 million in the plant and create 50 new jobs. In return, the city would give the company $1.6 million over 10 years. That money will come from tax increment financing. The council will also consider the second reading of measures to adopt an updated fire code and impose some regulations on dog breeders. Next story from the front page. EPA again allowing summer sales of higher ethanol gasoline blend. The Environmental Protection Agency cleared the way Friday for a higher blend of ethanol to be sold nationwide for the third summer in a row, citing global conflicts that it says are putting pressure on the world's fuel supply. The agency announced an emergency waiver that will exempt gasoline blended with 15% alcohol from an existing summertime ban. Gasoline with 10% ethanol is already sold nationwide, but the higher blend has been prohibited in the summer because of concerns it could worsen smog during warm weather. EPA Administrator Michael Regan said the waiver was warranted because of, quote, Russia's unjustified, unprovoked, and unconscionable war against Ukraine and the ongoing conflict in the Middle East, which he said are putting pressure on the global fuel supply. He said the diminished U.S. refining capacity is also a factor. The biofuels industry and politicians in the Midwestern states where ethanol is produced from corn praised the EPA's decision. They have portrayed ethanol as a product that helps farmers, reduces prices at the pump, and lessens greenhouse gases because the fuel burns more cleanly than gasoline. Allowing uninterrupted sales of E15 will help extend gasoline supplies, prevent fuel shortages, protect air quality, and reduce carbon emissions, said Renewable Fuels Association President and CEO Jeff Cooper. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds called the decision a huge victory for Iowa farmers, American energy independence, and consumers. Environmentalists and others, however, have said increased ethanol production can increase carbon releases because it results in more corn production, leading to increased use of fertilizer and greater releases of nitrate. Synthetic and natural fertilizers also are a leading source of water pollution. Iowa leads the nation in ethanol production, followed by Nebraska, Illinois, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Indiana. Most gasoline sold across the country today is blended with 10% ethanol, though 15% blends are becoming increasingly common, especially in the Midwest. The EPA has approved sales of E15 cars and trucks manufactured after 2000. The RFA estimates that the higher blend will cost consumers more than 25 cents a gallon less than the 10% ethanol. Earlier this year, the EPA permanently approved year-round E15 sales in 8 Midwestern states starting next year. The waiver announced Friday is temporary and only applies to this year. Corn crib destroyed in Sunday blaze. Firefighters stopped spread to other buildings on rural Harcourt Farm. An old corn crib on a southern Webster County farm was destroyed by fire Sunday evening. No one was injured. Firefighters prevented the blaze from spreading to any other buildings. The fire was located at 3585 Kansas Avenue, and it was reported at 4:37 p.m. Dayton Fire Chief Luke Hainzinger was nearby when the fire broke out, and he was the first firefighter on the scene. He said embers from a pile of burning brush landed on the wood-shake shingles on the roof of the corn crib. He said within a couple of minutes, the situation progressed from a small fire on the peak of the roof to the structure being engulfed in flames. Preventing the flames from spreading to anything else was the priority for firefighters. Water was sprayed onto a nearby tractor, a propane tank, garage, and a house. They made a really good stop and protected the exposures, Hainzinger said. The corn crib was allowed to collapse in flames. Its remains continued to smolder on Sunday night. The property is owned by Blake and Kylie Cromery, according to online records at the Webster County Assessor's Office. Firefighters from Harcourt, Gowrie, Dayton, Callander responded. Webster County Sheriff's deputies and Gowrie Police were also on the scene. And we're going back to Saturday's Fort Dodge Messenger. Here on the front page is a photo of the interior and the stage of the newly renovated Decker Auditorium at Iowa Central Community College when they were having an open house on Friday. Headline says, Iowa Central unveils new home for theater and music. Music could be heard within minutes after the doors opened for the first time Friday at the new Center for Performing Arts and renovated Decker Auditorium on the Iowa Central Community College's campus. L. Clark, an Iowa Central student who plays Belle in the upcoming musical Beauty and the Beast, stood on an auditorium stage and sang Home, which is one of her numbers from the show. Over in the new marching and concert band room, a percussion ensemble entertained guests. And upstairs in the new Center for Performing Arts, people filled a corridor to listen to a singing group. Friday's event marked the public debut of the facilities following a nearly two-year-long construction project that cost about $14.5 million. We pulled off quite a miracle, said college president Jesse Ulrich. Our community believes in the fine arts. The ambassadors from the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance conducted a ribbon cutting to mark the debut of the facilities. This is something that will not only improve the lives of the students here at Iowa Central, but will be truly a gem for the community and the families in the community for generations to come, he said. That was said by actually Matt Johnson on behalf of the ambassadors. Teresa Jackson, theater director at Iowa Central, handled the golden colored scissors to snip to the green ribbon. Our team is overwhelmed with gratitude, she said. Thank you beyond measure. Ulrich thanked the Iowa Central Board of Trustees, the Iowa Central Foundation, the college's music and theater faculties, OPN Architects of Des Moines, and general contractor Klinger Construction of Sioux City, and the local subcontractors for their work on the project. The facilities were opened for self-guided tours after the ribbon cutting. Decker Auditorium was built in the early 1970s. Very little in the way of upgrades have been done to it since then. The auditorium was essentially gutted. Then new electrical, lighting, and sound systems were installed. New seating was put in. The entire building was made accessible in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And those sitting in the balcony will now have access to bathrooms on that level for the first time. Several years ago, the auditorium was named for Dale and Donna Decker. Their son and daughter-in-law, Diane and Don Decker, donated $1 million for the auditorium project. Ulrich publicly thanked the Deckers Friday for their lead gift to the effort. He said Decker Auditorium is the most public building on the campus. He said 50,000 people go through it every year. With about 1,200 seats, it remains the largest venue in the area. The new two-story Center for Performing Arts was built onto the south side of Decker Auditorium. The first floor has a large room where the marching and concert bands can practice, a shop for building theatrical sets, an instrument and ensemble room, two dressing rooms directly behind the stage, a drama and theater room, small rooms where musicians can practice, and faculty offices. Upstairs, there are two classrooms, a large music classroom, and a conference room. And then our next story from the front page of Saturday's Messenger. Lake City grad serves as the senior enlisted leader at Virginia Navy Base. Major Chief Petty Officer David Sandine, a native of Lanesboro, Iowa, serves as the U.S. Navy assigned to Joint Expeditionary Base Little Creek. Sandine graduated from Lake City High School in 1985. The skills and values needed to succeed in the Navy are similar to those found in Lanesboro. I learned growing up the value of hard work and tenacity, said Sandine. When you grow up in a farming community, there's no, I can't get this done. You have to figure it out. He joined the Navy in 1986 and served aboard multiple ships deployed to the North Atlantic, Pacific, Indian Ocean, Arabian Gulf, and Mediterranean Sea. He had a 10-year break in service that allowed him to serve at Navy and Marine Corps Reserve Centers in Des Moines, Iowa, and Milwaukee. Today, Sedin serves as the Command Master Chief aboard Joint Expeditionary Base Little Creek. I joined the Navy to better my life, he said. According to Navy officials, Joint Expeditionary Base Little Creek Fort Story is the country's premier installation for housing and training the nation's expeditionary forces. It's one command with two properties, Joint Expeditionary Base Fort Story and Joint Expeditionary Base Fort Little Creek. The Joint Expeditionary Base is comprised of the former Naval Amphibious Base Little Creek and Army Post of Fort Story. Fort Story witnessed the humble beginnings of the nation at the 1607 first landing site. Little Creek began as a dynamic training ground for World War II amphibious forces. With 90% of global commerce traveling by sea and access to the internet relying on the security of undersea fiber optic cable, Navy officials continue to emphasize that the prosperity of the United States is directly linked to recruiting and retaining talented people from across the rich fabric of America. Sandine serves a Navy that operates far forward, around the world and around the clock, promoting the nation's prosperity and security. Quote, "We will earn and reinforce the trust and confidence of the American people every day," said Admiral Lisa Franchetti, Chief of Naval Operations. "Together, we will deliver the Navy the nation needs." Sandine has many opportunities to achieve accomplishments during military service. "I'm most proud of my family," he said. "All four of my sons followed in my footsteps and joined the Navy." Sandine can take pride in serving America through military service. "Serving in the Navy helps me help others," he said. "The only reason I do this is to help sailors. Knowing their life is better motivates me to keep serving." He's grateful to others for helping make a Navy career possible. "My wife, Christiane, is as much a factor for my career as anything," he added. "We got married before I joined the Navy, so she has been with me through the entire Navy journey," he said. And turning to obituaries, the Fort Dodge Messenger. Delphine Dell Johnson called home April 16 after a courageous battle with chronic heart failure. She was just 15 days shy of her 100th birthday. Celebration of Life, Tuesday, May 7th, at the Celebration Center at Friendship Haven, 2 p.m. Tuesday, May 7th. Up next, let's see if there's a memorial. Yes, memorials may be left to the Friendship Haven Good Samaritan Fund or the American Legion Auxiliary Post 21 in Lakota, North Dakota. Douglas Doug Crimmins passed away April 13th, 2024, at his home in Fort Dodge. Services are happening today, Monday, April 22nd, at the Holy Trinity in Fort Dodge. Loffersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Joyce R. Gailey, age 80, of Fort Dodge, passed away Thursday, April 18th at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Celebration of Life, Saturday, April 27, 2 p.m. at the Loffersweiler Funeral Home. Memorials will be at the discretion of the family. Johnny B. Naylor, age 80, of Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday, April 17th at the University of Iowa Hospitals. Funeral services, Saturday, April 27, 10 a.m. at the Loffersweiler Funeral Home. Burial to follow at the North Lawn Cemetery. A visitation will take place Friday, April 26th, from 4 to 7 at the funeral home. And then we'll turn to opinions. These come from Saturday's paper. There weren't any today in the Fort Dodge Messenger. This is a letter from Chuck Peterson of Fort Dodge. Chuck writes, "Don't blame Republicans for border mess." Back in March, President Biden presented his State of the Union address. The mainstream media and Democrats promoted the address as an opportunity for Biden to showcase his mental state and put to rest the prevailing thought that he, Biden, was lacking in mental capacity to be president for another 4 years. Whatever his handlers gave him worked. On the upside, he had enough energy to shout and raise his voice virtually the entire speech. On the downside, he spoke fast and at times mumbled and slurred his words. At one point, he was shamed into saying the name of the young student killed in Georgia in late February, allegedly by an illegal immigrant. Biden mispronounced the first name of the student and then added, "an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal." Biden was subsequently roundly criticized by the progressive left and many Democrats for using the word illegal. Biden then apologized for doing so. Notably, he did not apologize for mispronouncing the name of the victim. It didn't take long for the real Joe Biden and his gaffes to return. The very next day, during a campaign stop in Pennsylvania, he asked the voters to send me to Congress. Later, he said, "We cut the deficit and we added more to the national debt than any president in his term in all of history, than under Donald Trump." Even later, he referred to the January 6, 2021 Capitol riots as taking place on July 6. In his speech, Biden blamed Republicans for not approving a border bill. In the opinion page of The Messenger, opinions of something newsworthy at the time are expressed as political cartoons. On Monday, March 4, the political cartoon was the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, shown to be like Moses holding tablets defining the Trump commandments. The second commandment was no bipartisan border security bill, so it stays an issue. News at the time was that former President Trump had called and asked Johnson and other Republicans in the House to not vote for the border bill passed in the Senate. Because Trump's actions are worthy of being in the news for weeks at a time, the very same political cartoon was printed in the opinion page on Monday, March 18. It should be pointed out that the border security bill would have allowed nearly 5,000 encounters a day. By my math, 5,000 a day would be over 1,800,000 a year. To put that number in perspective, According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the number of illegal immigrants encountered at the southern border in Trump's last year in office was 458,088. In Biden's first 3 years in office, the number is 7,156,660, with known gotaways of over 1,700,000, plus a number of unknown gotaways that run away from the border and evade being counted or stopped. Trump and Republicans counter the border bill controversy by pointing out that old Joe doesn't need any congressional legislation. Within days of his inauguration in 2021, he signed executive orders reversing many of Trump's policies that were working. See the numbers above. With the stroke of his pen, Biden could restore Trump's successful border policy to control illegal immigrants at the border, and he could have done so years ago. Don't blame Republicans. And that letter was sent in by Chuck Peterson of Fort Dodge. And that's all the time we have today for the readings of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger. You're listening to Iris. It's a pleasure to read for you. Have a great day.